There's a little demographic thing that's being circulated. The sheet with all of the figures obviously is not updated, which I think is a visible topography of the times and might betray a kind of uncanny attempt on the part of the church to remain, if you will, in the 1960s or even the 1860s. The map itself is to give you some sort of general overview of how the geography looks in my parish, which is determined at this point by the freeway systems of the East Bay area. California, I would suppose, is best described in a book called Westward Tilt, which depicts this country as being carried on the arms of a giant. And the giant starts to make a step and stubs his toe. And as he leans forward, the country tilts towards the west coast, and everything that wasn't nailed down rolled towards California and other states. And so the kind of people that you've got out there are obviously the adventuresome types and the ne'er-do-wells and others. It is said in my parish that California is a state with a governor who eats peanut butter or some reasonable facsimile. It's also the land of hippies, the Telegraph Avenue scene, the hate, and above all, I would suppose, a fantastically beautiful black population. When one attempts at this point to start defining his own ministry in terms of what's being done, he's kind of at a loss to in defining it, basically because I cannot say that I had X number of X numbers of confirmands last year. I cannot say that there were so many adult accessions to my parish. I can't produce any kind of canvas card which has, in fact, the names of people on the dotted lines. There are, in fact, no justifiable returns for my ministry. Somebody asked our district president about 3 weeks ago, what is it that guy Hertzfeld does? He says, well, first of all, he's working to see if it's possible to create riotous-type situations in Oakland. And when he has time, he attempts to preach the gospel. Another question to the district president was, who is this made-up Negro that you've got running around the state, the district, encouraging young white people to go to the Haight-Ashbury and get venereal disease, or encouraging them to paint peace symbols on buildings or to tear trees up from off of the streets of Oakland? All of this is kind of exciting, and at the same time, I would suppose, kind of gratifying, because for the first time in 2 years, I would suppose, California Lutherans, who are predominantly white, know that I'm there, and that there are some justifiable returns for the ministry. The ministry for the first 6-7 months was that of creative listening. You heard CT talk, for example, last evening about how it's possible in the years of seminary training and what have you to so brainwash the black preacher that he's got to take 10 years, you know, to catch up with the stuff as he should know it when he attempts to minister to people. My own background is no exception to the general rule. I attended a seminary in Greensboro, North Carolina, for which I am thankful at this point, because it did not succeed in doing this. The then executive secretary of the Synodical Conference upon our graduation, after some trouble in Greensboro, which started with the sit-ins, said that, Hertzfeld, you ought to recognize, first of all, that the church has spent an awful lot of time and money so that you might be a pastor to your people. And consequently, when you start to go off on these tangents, and what you ought to do is to recognize that the church has done all of this for you, and consequently you ought to be concerned about producing for the church. For 5.5 years, I would suppose I did this in Alabama, as I joined friend Joe traveling through Mississippi in the dead of night, as we went to jail, as we watched people being hosed down, and as we, in fact, joined them. And 2 years now in California has not changed my mind too much about it, except that I think that those were good days while they were, but never again. Let's do what I call a historical overview of California, and then I'll talk a little bit about some of the things that are happening there, not in terms of the results that they've produced, but in terms of ideas, in terms of dreams that this ministry has. Until World War II, California's Negro population didn't grow as rapidly as its white population. In 1860, there were about 4,000 black people, which made up about 1.1% of the California population. From 1940 to 1960, there was a sevenfold increase, over and above the 124,000 that came in 1940. The Negro population in Alameda County experienced a slow but steady growth. Alameda County is that county which is located towards the ocean on the map. From 1860 to 1940, the population was greatly accelerated by the impact of black folks migrating from the South to engage in wartime industry. Alameda County has experienced a rate of Negro growth almost three times that of the general population of any other sector of the country, other than maybe Detroit, New York, or Chicago. In general, minority groups tend to reside mainly in the central cities, as they do in other parts of the country. In California, one out of every seven residents in central cities belong to a minority race, compared with one out of 25 in the urban fringes surrounding the central cities. Negroes comprise the greatest number of newcomers, and their pattern follows the typical migratory pattern of first moving to the central city and then attempting to move out of it to something different. Within the county of Alameda, then, the difference between central cities and rural and or suburban fringe is clearly drawn, with 98% of that population living in the northern part of the county, mainly in Oakland and in Berkeley. The same thing is also true of San Francisco. The San Francisco environs, the peninsula and what have you, follows pretty much the same basic line of the map that you have on the East Bay. In California at present, the proportion of non-white males age 14 and over in the labor force is only slightly less than the proportion in the total population. However, unemployment among minority groups persons is much higher. In fact, it's now double that of the other folks in the area. Now, this data, I think, shows that at least 1.7% of the white folks, males 14 years and over, are institutionalized, and that 3.7% of black and Mexican Americans and Indians are in institutions. Somebody said once that the big issue in California, other than Ronnie Baby's asinine antics, is that of capital punishment. Of the 72 men that we've got on death row in San Quentin Prison now, 68 of them are either black or Mexican. When we started the ministry, somebody said that the call itself was so ambiguous that they couldn't really understand, how a guy could bring himself to the point where he could accept it. That's precisely why it did. I'm basically a lazy guy. It said nothing. I thought that I would have to do nothing. And, of course, it's generally true, I suppose, most of us. But with the mass migration of people into the East Bay section, there's been a shortage of alert. There's been a shortage of sensitivity. Black urban leadership has not been the kind of leadership that was able to exert real power and influence in a community like this. And in too many instances, even the black clergymen have had a kind of narrow definition of the pastoral functions, and they feel quite inadequate to cope with the problems, both present problems and futuristic problems. ought to be tackled by someone if any meaningful resolution of them is to be effective, and this is the kind of mindset we are operating with. To start with the creative listening, some of my best pastors now, incidentally, are not the pastors in the district. Most of them are good guys, but some of the best pastors are the guys in the pool halls and the prostitutes who usually adorn the streets of Oakland and San Francisco after night falls. One classic example of a guy who became my pastor was a guy who was taking me for at an average of $2.50 a week at pool. It was at that point that I suddenly remembered, you know, that at least the half black part of me could operate with a deal of proficiency, and so we started to take him for some money. And a couple of months ago, he said, "Hey, Rev, I think you ought to tell me about this Jesus cat now, because any cat who could bring you this far in such a short time must have something going for him." He says, "No, man, when I tried to tell you about him, you wouldn't listen. Now shut up, nigga, and play pool." So I would suppose that this might, in effect, speak to some of the frustrations of those who are wondering, how do you do the gospel, you know, in the midst of much of what's happening to you in terms of the city. There are other examples, but we don't want to burden the group with too many of those. I always say that the church probably started to operate with a ministry of the type that I have now, basically because of the fantastic decline in the membership of core city churches. And they recognized that there was some inequity, if you will, in the PR of the institution. It's like a banking firm which suddenly experiences that kind of decline. And they don't accuse people of being bad financial investors and stuff like this, but they attempt to get at the source of the problem. So we really start the ministry with what we call doing the right things for the wrong reasons. And some of us then have had our minds blown, our sense of directions rectified. We're starting, I think, to deal with a great deal of proficiency now as we attempt to work out the problem. First of all, if I were to divide my time for you, I think that there is a period at which I continue to attempt, if you will, to do exactly what I'm trying to do now, articulate what is in terms of the ecology of the town, in terms of what has happened as a result of racism and what have you, and we call it taking flack from suburban white folks for some of our suburban white pastors, which isn't a bad thing if one starts to recognize that there is a gleam of hope in terms of the white brother recognizing what his community is like and certainly dealing with those problems. And at the same time, contrary to a lot of opinion, recognizing the non-difference, if you will, between the core cities of Oakland, Berkeley, Richmond, and what have you, and also those satellite communities which are marked white on the map, who control, if you will, the core city. First thing that we started to listen to was a thing that was done by a group of political leaders in the Bay Area counties. It's a group called ABAG, you know, the Association of Bay Area Governments. The executive director recently walked off with $500,000, which meant that we have some white friends in that institution who are as dedicated to the destruction of that thing as some of the black folks are. For whatever reason, at the same time, he contributed rather heftily to its downfall. When I talk to, for example, suburban churches, or when I conduct forums or training sessions, weekday schools, and what have you, then I talk about this non-difference, and I start out sometimes by saying perhaps if one wants to conduct a valid ministry in terms of dealing with this non-difference, then probably the most effective ministry for the young priest of today is to set up a confession booth at the intersections of the freeways at rush hour. 9 o'clock in the morning, when people are operating under a kind of misguided adulation that the city wakes up at that hour, and between 4 and 6 in the afternoon, when they suspect that the city is closed down, and they agonize on the freeway between suburbia and downtown. I would suppose also there is a need at this point for somebody who can be objective to point out certain landmarks in San Francisco and Oakland. Those landmarks are obviously the Bay Bridge and the Golden Gate Bridge. To date, 338 folks have gone off of the Golden Gate Bridge. Only one was black, and somebody suspects that he was pushed. So there's some question, you know, as to where a valid ministry could be conducted, and perhaps also a worthwhile investment would be that of pith helmet and white suits for black preachers who still want to take the time to deal with the heathen in suburbia, and also to address themselves to the frustrations of saved. Now that's a part of what we do when we attempt to relate meaningfully to Lutheran and other Lutheran congregations in the California and Nevada district. Travel takes me as far into the hinterlands as Reno and Las Vegas, you know, and Fallon and some of the other desert communities, where people, incidentally, react much more positively, and the groups are much less hostile than those groups that are within the immediate confines of the Bay Area. It could be that removal or from the problem being a light year from being affected by it has something to do with this. I don't know. There is, in fact, a kind of absence of the kind of fears that we've experienced in suburban churches. So that particular bag is that of consulting, sensitizing, and developing, if you will, an awareness on the part of white people that they've got to do their thing in terms of ministering to communities that behind the facade of green grass and bird singing and all of the other fineries and adornments of an affluent society, there's a great deal of frustration and pain, and that this is the community that contributes directly to the hate, to the Telegraph Avenue scene, and to other fantastically beautiful communities that are forming now on the horizon, where young people trying to find a sense of community, some meaningful existence for themselves, abdicate, take off, drop out, because of their inability to deal with the obvious phoniness and hypocrisy that's associated with that kind of living. That's a tired process, and I hope to call this to a screeching halt real soon. I have made it my business at this point to announce to congregations that I will return to no congregation more than once, at least in this particular block of time, give or take 5 years, give or take a couple of years. One appearance is enough after you have discovered that black folks don't have tails, and believe it or not, there are a lot of folks who still suspect this. It's a part of the myth of, you know, the black man being afraid of him from the waist down and other things that you that you heard a few minutes ago. And after they have also discovered why he doesn't even talk like a Negro, that's a strange kind of identification, I would suppose, or loss of identification, then I figure that everybody's been sorensified, and so we should move on to something more important. One of the most interesting groups, and I'll just share this with you, that I've had was a group of men and women, mostly women, in a congregation in Santa Clara. We had 14 grueling weeks of discovery in that particular congregation. And now the project, just to show you the kind of results that are produced of the local Lutheran Women's Missionary Group, as one of the guys describes this, LWML stands, at least for me, it means Lutheran Women Made Larger. You know, take that any way you want. But anyway, this beautiful group of society matrons now has as their project for the coming year the rolling of bandages for riots this summer. Now, you're laughing, but they aren't. They are working like beavers rolling bandages for riots. And they're prepared at this point to ship them to any number of cities who will probably experience at this time, in this summer, some of the most pernicious forms of destruction and death that this country has ever known. That's a pretty prophetic action, and frankly, some of us are quite happy with the results of that particular venture. At the same time, this is a very, I think, moving witness to the community around them in terms of giving vent to their utter hopelessness and despair over the situation, and at the same time maintaining certain things that are built into the Protestant work ethic of which Missouri Synod Lutherans are famous or infamous, the case might be. Tim left out one other thing that we're attempting to do, basically because the ministry has been one of unconventional, unstructured natures. The Prince of Peace Volunteer Program was gotten off of the ground by us, and now for the first time we feel that we've got the kind of program which reverses the plantation charity mentality, which has been and still is part and parcel of young white students who want to come in and help into discovering what they're all about. Last summer, there's one man in here who went through the thing with us. Sometimes maybe he could share with you his own experiences. We're not going to take the time to do that, but this has been a rather exciting part of my ministry in working with young white youth and watching them discover themselves and doing some rather tired things, smelling each other's dirty feet and socks. They don't live in homes with black folks. That's verboten. They live together in one house, boys and girls together and what have you. And they do the kind of sock smelling and discovering of each other that we think is necessary at this point in an entirely different context from the kind of context that that they're obviously used to. Now, I think the main thrust of the ministry at the beginning also was relating to those ecumenical parishes which are determined by the geographical lines of the city. There is an ecumenical parish for every section of the city: North Oakland, West Oakland, East Oakland, Southeast Oakland, Piedmont, and other sectors. This became, for me, as Jim Cross knows, a kind of tired process. Basically because of our inability to communicate, I would suppose, to the white clergymen that you don't have to look what they call the part to work in the ghetto, but that you should shine your shoes, clean yourself up, and look decent, you know. For your own people, you may look that way if it does anything for your ego, but not for the black people. The embryonic overloads suddenly released on a community with all kinds of manufactured programs and answers and stuff like this without ever perceiving what the problem is. So at this point now, war has been declared even on the ecumenical parishes by another ecumenical group which requires the rest of my time, called the Alamo Black Clergy. And here I'd just like to read from this thing which we have developed, and to give you some sort of an overview of what this particular ministry looks like now and what we hope to look like in the future. Starts off, and Joe lacks this phrase, out of the implosive imperative to deal with the mounting potential explosiveness within the inner city. Boy, you know, you get a group of brothers together and they can really blow. You know, that's a part of the blowing right here. Betrays, I would suppose, an ability to deal with the Queen's English or the King's English, whoever it is at this point, with a great deal of proficiency. But anyway, out of this came the motive force for the genesis of the black clergy. During the months of the development of this group, cohesiveness has grown out of long periods of time spent in doing what we call gestalt therapy, which is a new kind of sensitizing thing, which means that we take off to Big Sur and the Echelon and other places of ill repute, and we shut off, if you will, much of the world around us, screech of tires, smell of asphalt and concrete, and a lot of other things, so that we can think about and reflect on our interpersonal relationships and develop theological foundations for these relationships and an in-depth reading of our community, i.e. The black community. There are 23 men represented on the immediate steering committee. It's a kind of theological montage that that we've got represented, I would suppose, in Holiness, American Baptist, National Baptist, Episcopalian, Unitarian Universalist, Reforms, Christian Methodist Episcopal, African Methodist Episcopal, almost every denomination represented in the group. And to date, we have, after our sensitizing and what have you, attempted to develop a strategy, recognizing that while we are all moving in the circles, and all of these men are doing the same kind of thing, especially those who are working with establishment denominations, that we must retire, if you will, from white folks, so that we can get the fog out of our brains and do the kind of thing that's needed at this point to deal realistically with the multifaceted problems of the city. And to date, the Alamo Black clergy has worked at and have employed detached workers in the city of Oakland, young laymen who are not preachers, who don't even pretend to be, some not even Christian, but at the same time recognizing that what we're really concerned about is our corporate survival, and that the black church at this point and the black preacher still rests, if you will, at the apex of all of the triangles that could ever be drawn to describe adequately what a community is all about. Teaching, after being taught by men like Huey Newton, who is Minister of Defense for the Black Panthers, by Bobby Seale, who is also with the Minister of Defense wing of the Black Panther Party. Black history, culture, and all kinds of things which are zeroing in, I would suppose, on the black power lifestyle, which is so much a part of between 48% and 51% of black people, no matter what you say, including black bourgeois people. In fact, one middle class black man who talked to us finally, after going through one of the sessions with us, says, "You know what, reverends, I want you to know how the middle class black man really feels." And so he talked to us about how he and his wife sat in front of their color television set and watched Detroit burn, and they held their hands together and they cried with the crowd, "Burn, baby, burn." And there's a kind of vicarious thing that happens, and it's happening more and more to middle-class black people. And this is one of the discoveries that we've made. And so what we want to do is take all of this talent, along with the intellectual prowess that's represented there, convert it into something meaningful and useful that's overt action, and to use it as we have used nothing else in our lives. There are also conversations and fights with all of the seminaries in the Bay Area. You know, there's a fantastic amount of seminaries. There are only 40 black seminarians, incidentally, in all of the seminaries on both sides of the Bay. So we've initiated conversations with them. I don't need to go into that. The anti-seminary thing that CT presented is not new to us. Some of us know what that means. Some of us have even participated now. And instead of marching into suburbia and taking bricks and screams and shouts and yells and abuse from white folks, we'd rather take it from seminary professors, which is as good a route as any, I would suppose, at this particular stage of the game. The black clergy then, too, has worked on and has been fairly successful in developing a black unity council, which has pulled together all of the divergent groups of black leaders, grassroots folks, and what have you, into a council. And incidentally, the first two meetings of the black unity council was spent castigating the guys who called it together. And that was good, I thought, you know.
a physical and mental castration, if you will, of the black preacher, who incidentally called the group together and called it together specifically for that purpose, you know, basically because some of us had succumbed to a certain amount of fear of being told the truth by lay folks.